This is Radical Love Live, an ongoing series of podcasts and special events where we explore faith outside the boxes. Hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson.
Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm awesome. And you?
I'm good.
It's always good to see you, my friend. And glad we're here doing another episode of Radical Love Live.
Here we are.
So what are we talking about today, Kelly?
Well, I was thinking that we might talk about the subject of salvation and what we're being saved from. Let me give you a little context. You know that sometimes when I'm driving in the car, I listen to contemporary Christian music.
Okay.
It's all like Christian Nickelback, but
Jesus save me.
I really do. I like jamming out to that, but yep. I have to carefully curate it because sometimes the theology is a little off from where I am. Like all the stuff that's like holy, holy God, you know, everything's great, you know, like I like those songs, but then there's all these songs that are like, I am so grateful that you love me, even though I'm broken.
You're broken.
And every time I hear that, I'm like, where, like scripturally, theologically, are they getting the idea of like, we're broken.
Yeah.
This thing that we need to be saved from, like saved from ourselves, like broken from the, and it, so it got me thinking about salvation, what we're being saved from, original sin, a lot of that stuff. And I know this is huge for one episode, so we'll try to keep it tight.
So, folks, this is about a 4.5-hour podcast.
At least.
No, I'm just joking, in. Folks. Don't.
Yeah. Take that, Oppenheimer.
That's right. We're going to go into it. Go for it.
So, you know, salvation is one of those things that I grew up with in evangelical background, where I really thought that that was the focus of Christianity, that it was, you're bad, you know, everyone has sinned, you're guilty of sin from birth, deserving hell, and the purpose of Christianity is for you then to come have a relationship with Jesus, get saved, and then you've got like your fire insurance, like you're not going to hell anymore.
That's right. Your fireproof suit.
Right.
Just for joining, you also get a lifetime supply of fire extinguishers as well. But you gotta participate, right, for that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And the basis for all that is a certain interpretation of of some of the writings of Paul, but also looking back at the Adam and Eve story, was saying like, here's Adam and Eve. They were told to do a thing. They were tempted. They did the thing. And then because of that, there's this kind of like inherited curse through all of mankind. Everything's fallen. Everything's broken. And it's the complete opposite of the idea of God created creation, and creation is good.
Okay, and I'll let you dive in anywhere you want to go, because you, in our preparation for this conversation, clearly have some questions and some, you know, share some of your viewpoints, and I'm going to tag along for fun and games as well here. But you just brought up something right there that I wanted to kind of dive into.
Yeah.
Was this notion that, yes, we had Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis. We have the thing that led up to Eve doing what she did, right? And the temptation, the snake, et cetera. And in that moment, because of what happened, all of a sudden, everything afterward is now cursed? Is that the word?
Yeah, it's like this contagious disease that infected everything. Like everything suddenly was subject to death and disease, and people had to work, and childbirth was painful all of a sudden. Where, and I have a little bit of a different look at that. I look at the Adam and Eve. Look at Adam and Eve as a mythical story, but that's got some truth to it.
Okay.
So if you remember the tree that they were not supposed to eat from was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Okay.
And so you've got these two sort of innocents wandering around the garden, and they do something that then gives them the knowledge of like, wow, I'm naked. Wow, I have to go to work.
Yeah.
Wow, things hurt. Mm. Wow, death is possible. Mm. What that says to me is not that they did something that caused those things to happen, but more that they became aware that those things happen. It's almost like children growing up in the state of innocence and then at some point kind of losing their innocence and being like, oh, wow, this world is hard. Mm. Oh, now I have to go to work.
Mm.
Now I have to be aware of my mortality. Mm. So to me, that seems like it seems like a mythical story about coming of age. And then, wow. Like, I don't know that they had a choice. Like, you imagine, like, you're Adam and Eve, you're in the garden. God says, like, here's the, you can do anything you want except this one thing.
That's right.
You know, think about human nature.
Right.
Like, was there, like, that was a setup.
Yeah, exactly. Don't go towards that tree. And if you see the snake, don't talk to the snake.
Right. Yeah. Then there's the mythical talking snake.
Yes.
So I think it was a natural part of humans becoming human, is now we know.
So let's take that back into time, because Genesis was written 5,000 plus years ago, right? Thereabouts.
Yep, shortly after the world came to be.
And yes, and dinosaurs were dying out. Although some say that there was an intersection there, that there were people running around riding dinosaurs at the same time. But yeah.
They had to get them on the ark. They had to choose just babies. Hey,
yeah.
Baby dinosaurs.
Baby dinosaurs, little dinosaurs. You can get on there.
Okay. Anyway.
Yes, we digress, folks. We digress. Sure. So 5,000 years ago, a coming of age story to tell children then would seem just as relevant then as it would today, because we live in today's time. So we think about everything being today for us, like our context. But wouldn't parents have to tell their kids the same thing? And maybe this is a great way in which to tell that story.
Yeah, yeah. Imagine a kid, you know, being like, hey, Grandpa, why do people die?
Yeah.
Let me tell you the story of Adam and Eve. This is how death got introduced into the world.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of mythical story tied with this entire history of people trying to be clean. But there's a whole, you know, throughout the Hebrew Bible, there's all these rituals to be clean, to be separate from other people, to be, you know, to show that your God is the real God and the other gods are the idols.
Yeah, the false idols.
And then Paul uses that when he talks about Jesus. Mm-hmm. He talks primarily about Jesus as a sacrifice. Although there are multiple other interpretations of Jesus's work on the cross and through his life and resurrection that don't get talked about as much, at least in those theological circles.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that in this conversation, of course.
Go all over the place.
Yeah, well, and I think as long as our listeners can follow our conversation, we're going to take them on a fun journey. So I think in the context of what we're talking about today, it is about salvation in Christian tradition. So let's put it up to that point. So, all right, salvation. When did our man Jesus talk about salvation?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that. Because when you look at the Gospels, if you look at the Gospels on their own, without any of the other, you know, the letters from Paul, Jesus barely talked about salvation at all.
Oh.
Like, that wasn't what he was here for.
Oh.
He did when he ran into people who were in sin, quote unquote, or who he thought they were in sin. He forgave them right away.
Yes, he did.
And he actually gave his apostles the authority to do that, too. He was like, you guys go forgive sin. And, you know, the religious people at the time, the religious authorities were going nuts because they're like, only God can forgive sins. And Jesus is like, oh, yeah.
Okay, so on that, I don't want to cut you off because I love where you're going here, but I didn't know that. Are you? Shows you how little I know of the Bible. But you're saying so the 12 apostles, they were empowered by the dude to absolve people of sin as well.
Uh-huh. Yep. Jesus said, "Go heal people and forgive them their sins."
Okay.
I can even look up the verse.
Wow. Okay, so that puts context to why priests and those folks that are ordained or empowered, however it comes to be, will absolve folks of sin. I've never thought about that. So that's a great thing for
him. Yeah, and he even, it was important to Jesus that people forgive one another. It's in the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forgive us our debts as we forgive those who...
This is true. It is, isn't it?
Our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Yes.
And, you know, when somebody asked him, well, how many times should I forgive my brother? 7 times? No, 70 times 7, which is this kind of symbolic number that means...
A lot.
A lot. Many, many times.
Whatever it is. Did you find it?
Let's see here.
He's looking up on the internet right now, folks.
Yeah. After his resurrection, Jesus told the disciples, if you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained.
Mm.
This is in John, who is very much about the godhood of Jesus, mm-hmm. which is, it's a little separate from the other three gospels.
That's correct.
Which had a different...
Yeah, John was doing his own thing.
Yes.
So, and you bring up a good point. So I could see, you know, we all know that this dude was a rabble-rouser and causing a lot of angst within the communities he was running around. So there are a lot of people who wanted him out of the way. And yes, you're right. If he was empowering people to absolve people and heal them, you know, they heal their souls for the sins that they've committed, that would be a problem for the religion of the day. In this case,
well, there's a whole economic system built around it. Like people would travel to Jerusalem to be able to go to the temple. They would change their money from whatever it was, you know, they'd go to the, you know, cash exchange.
The cambio?
So that, yeah, exactly. So that they could buy the perfect sacrificial animal that they needed to use for this particular sin, because they couldn't bring it from home. Like if you brought your spotless dove from home, it'd probably die on the trip.
A practical thing, that's right.
But there's a whole economy built about this, which is something to think about when Jesus then made a whip out of cords and went into the temple and threw the money changers out.
So you and I both love that, because I like that. I just love the fact that, you know, he was very deliberate. Not only did he go throwing tables around, but he also made this whip out of cord.
He could have grabbed a stick or a rock or something. Like, no, he's sitting there like making this thing.
Yeah, he was very intentional in this thing.
Whip them out. Yeah.
So salvation. You say that he actually doesn't say a lot about it, but it was just about the forgiveness. You mentioned, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say what the core of Jesus's teaching is this concept of the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven in Matthew. He doesn't want to say the name of God because he's very, it's like very Jewish tradition of not actually speaking the name of God.
So you mean like G-D kind of, yes.
Exactly.
Okay.
But it's the same concept, is that Jesus is teaching about this kind of reign of God. And reign, like rulership.
R-E-I-G-N, reign, not yes, R-A-I-N.
And it's kind of a new state of being. And it's there's all these different aspects to it, that it's something that's going to happen, but it also is something that's started now. And it has a certain set of values that kind of turn the world's power structures on its head. That's where you get like, blessed are the poor, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed, you know, that kind of elevates the poor. And it's within this context that Jesus says to the rich man, you know, if you want to get into the kingdom of heaven, sell all your stuff and give it to the poor. And the rich man went away sadly.
Yes.
That was how that story went.
Yes. Like, yeah.
But Jesus is teaching about this kingdom, which he and his followers think is going to happen like tomorrow. You know, he at one point Jesus says, like, this generation won't pass away before all things are fulfilled.
Oh.
So he actually predicts that the kingdom of God will come into its fulfillment before all the people standing around him die.
Okay, that's an important point. I don't know how much that's discussed. I mean, maybe in Bible study and in the dissection of Scripture, especially what Jesus is documented as saying, or, you know, or claim. Okay, and that's one I missed. So he said that it's going to happen right now, like before these people standing in front of me are going to die off.
Yeah, that's
so that's like 10, 20 years from now.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why you see in Paul, one of the phrases that conservatives like to throw around when they talk about welfare or whatever is that, like, he says, if you don't work, you shouldn't eat.
Oh, I didn't know that either. I guess maybe I need to pay more attention to Bible study or something.
But what he's talking about is people who, they're like, the world's going to end tomorrow, so why should I work? I'm just going to go. I'm just going to hang out with my friends and sleep on their couch and eat their leftovers.
Exactly. Binge watch Netflix.
He's like, no, you still got to work. Just, you know, stay busy. Jesus is watching.
That's interesting. So is that a thought of your own, or have you encountered this and you've had conversations with others about this?
It's one of those things in my undergraduate theological studies that we talked about is what this whole idea of this end times is coming really quickly. The values of this kingdom that's going to kind of take over the earth are already in place. So already start acting like you're in the kingdom. Like everlasting life starts now.
Okay.
But listen to how different this is from, I deserve to go to hell, therefore I lay down at the altar and pray for Jesus to come into my heart. Like, this is a whole different.
Oh, much different.
Story.
Yeah.
And it's not just personal. It's communal. It's about the community,
right?
Because it's in the kingdom of God, people are taking care of each other. Mm. You know, there's the whole the metaphor of the sheep and the goats, where, you know, like sending some to heaven, sending some to hell.
Yep.
That is about nations, not about individual people. That's at the end of a whole speech where Jesus is talking about, did you take care of the widows? Did you take care of the orphans? Did you take care of the prisoners? If you denied any of those people, then you denied me. And that's how I'll judge the nations. This is so different than, like, you know, did I get angry at somebody and didn't ask for forgiveness, therefore I have to be forgiven before, so I don't go to hell. It's a whole different way of looking at things.
Okay. So is salvation individual or is it of nations?
I guess to answer that, we have to talk about what salvation is.
Okay, fine. Let's go.
And that's, I brought some.
Uh-oh.
I brought reading materials.
Folks, he has books.
I have references.
He does. He even has them bookmarked where he's going to read.
Yes, I do.
So this
is a book. It's called Saving God.
Mm-hmm.
And this, it's a philosophy book. It's called Religion After Idolatry. And it's a philosophy book where this guy, the author,
Mark Jacobson. I see that on the cover.
Mark Johnston.
Mark Johnson.
And he's
apologize.
He's
apologies to Mark.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Then someday I will understand what this book is about. I've read it a couple times.
Okay. Remember who you're sitting next to, so you got to keep this simple. So break it down.
So he keeps elevating the idea of God. So that his idea is, like, if you have an imaginary picture of God, it can't actually be God because God is inconceivable. So even...
Oh, this is Jacobson saying this in the book.
Johnston. Yeah.
Johnston. Sorry. Mark Johnston.
So he's saying even that's a kind of idolatry and that God is even higher than... It relates a little bit into kind of some of the stuff we were talking about with Maria a couple weeks ago. It's kind of like God beyond...
And that's how I feel too. God is to me whatever you want to call it. You know, skip the name G-D, whatever. It's inconceivable. We cannot grasp it in this form. Okay.
Right. But I'm looking exactly for the the quote is what I wanted to talk about is that he's not, even though he is focused on this kind of like completely different God than the evangelicals would think about, he still has a sense of our having defects that we need to be saved from.
Johnston,
which is why he still holds on to some kind of God-like notion.
Okay.
And he, through the book, he explains how he gets to this point of like how we get redeemed.
Okay.
But he says, genuine or true religion must be genuinely directed upon what religion is for. there are certain large-scale structural defects in human life that no amount of psychological adjustment or practical success can free us from. These include arbitrary suffering, aging once it has reached the corrosive stage, our profound ignorance of our condition, the isolation of ordinary self-involvement, the vulnerability of everything we cherish to time and chance, and finally, to untimely death. So what he's saying, is, and this is, you know, when we think about people being broken, we don't want to think of babies as being in original sin or broken. Like, babies are innocent.
Yes, they are. But you even said that earlier at the top of this conversation that you know there are some that believe that we are absolutely born of original sin. Like, we're already done. We come out, we come sliding out the chute, and next thing you know, we're already or being pulled out if you're cesarean. But point being is that you're born into the world, and you're already a mess.
Right, you're already oriented toward rebellion and against the will of God. So
as you draw your first breath outside your mother's womb. Yes.
Right. So, and forgive me if this is too complicated an argument, but my argument is that people are not broken and sinful the moment they are born. I would argue that they are self-involved, which is natural for a baby to be self-involved.
Of course, because that's how that's how the baby keeps itself, by being cute and adorable, right. And like, in it is totally self-involved.
That's really why the mom doesn't eat it. Yeah,
or dad, for that matter, or something else. Yeah,
right. And then as we get older, we are still the center of our universe. So there's a certain amount of self-involvement that comes with being human.
Yes, I would agree.
So even in a situation where, you know, like for Johnston, he's sort of he's not getting to a secular God, but it's definitely like a God beyond
the one that we can appreciate or understand. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Even for him, he has to admit there's something about the human condition that needs to be fixed, that there are certain problems. And if you look around, you know, you want to think that people are good, but, you know, I used to think about it in terms of my commute. I had a 45-minute commute on the New York subway system. Mm-hmm. And just a 45-minute commute in the New York subway system, you can get a pretty good idea of human nature.
You sure can.
Like, the people who won't get out of the way of the door, the people that steal the seat from the pregnant ladies,
all of that.
You know,
I would agree. Yeah, because you see humanity functioning as it is.
Right, that kind of self-involvement.
Yep, it just is what it is.
Yeah. So for me, salvation is not removing my guilt so that I can now be innocent. That's what the idea of justification is. It's like, I'm guilty, but Jesus has kind of commuted my sentence.
So. That's true. And you know, I kind of have a problem with justification now that I understand it. I was like, what? You mean like I can just do this and I will have permanent justification and salvation and I'm good and I can do all kinds of things, and as long as I keep my faith, I can do anything.
Right. Exactly. I got my, you know, it's like I got my police sticker on the back of my car. So every time I get pulled over, I gave PBA. To the benevolent society.
Exactly. Or it's like your cape. Like, I've got my super cape and I'm good. So, anyway, to that.
So that salvation is changing that orientation from I'm the most important thing in the universe to everybody else is as important as I am.
Which I love that. But that's not an easy transformation.
No. There's every reason why someone would need a kind of like religious revelatory experience to have that change, because we're so naturally built for that, and that, you know, it takes work for us to start thinking about others, to start thinking about, you know, people we've hurt and need to make amends to, you know, to start getting that focus outside ourselves.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a question. Everybody knows my story. Like, I've been sober for a little over 10 years now, and I'm very grateful, because otherwise I would not be doing this conversation, because I must assuredly be dead by now. So in my first day of sobriety, was that my salvation?
Maybe.
I've never thought about it. But.
Well, that's another thing is that, you know, the tradition that I grew up in, there was a moment of salvation. There was that, you know, I walk up to the altar and I'm born again as of that moment.
Yeah.
I don't know that we get to declare that.
Well, I certainly did.
Anymore
not
than,
like I woke up. Well, I did wake up that morning and said, oh, I can't do this anymore. And as a very angry atheist, I asked God for help, which was the most warped thing. But that's exactly what happened.
Well, so. I think that's how salvation works, is that it starts when we turn ourselves. But then there's a growing process, like we're constantly being saved.
Okay. Yeah. I would go with
and
yes.
That's gets into, you know, that's what sanctification is. It's like slowly becoming better and better and better, ideally. But it's not linear. Like you can get better and then get worse and then get better again. But ideally, there's a progression.
I like that. So we just threw out three things there. Justification, salvation, and sanctification.
Yep.
So for some folks within the Christian tradition, once you're justified and you believe in faith, faith alone, then your salvation has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need any sanctification at that point? Or are you good?
I don't know. That's a good question, because that's more of a Calvinist tradition, idea like we're totally depraved.
Yep.
There's nothing we can do to save ourselves. But yeah, that's part of the total depravity is part of the Calvinist.
Oh.
And that there's nothing.
Sign
we can
me
do
for
to
a,
save
sign
ourselves.
Me up for that one. Wow, that's you are a piece of dog poo poo on the sidewalk.
Right, right, and that's what you know. The song that I'm listening to on the way over here is like I'm totally depraved. God, can you save me? And that you can't be saved by yourselves, and that actually God has to kind of elect you to be saved. And that's where predestination comes in. There was a whole branch of Calvinist churches that think, like, you don't know if you're going to heaven or not. You got picked.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's the cliffhanger, isn't
right.
it? Well, you don't know.
Can't
so you better be good
out.
Because – but you know what, folks? You still may go see Beelzebub and won't have a fireproof suit and a lifetime supply of fire extinguishers.
Yeah, well, thankfully, modern-day Baptists don't do that. They've taken more of what's called the Arminian view, which is
– I just read about that.
Everybody can – everybody has the opportunity
yes.
to be saved.
Yeah, yeah.
Through their faith.
Just read that. So. Speaking of which, while you're looking up something, so in preparation for today's conversation – I opened up my ChatGPT account, and I asked, so give me 10 talking points on Christian salvation. Boom, instantly. And I thought, well, that was quick. Let's see what happens when I ask it for 30. Boom, got him instantly. And then I asked it for 100. Boom, gave me those. So folks, I'm sharing that only because if you want to play around with AI at all, and, you know, there's now more than one tool out there. But as I said, I was using OpenAI, ChatGPT. It'll definitely give you things to think about, which was kind of cool. But it also in that, that's how I saw the difference between Calvinism and Arminianism. Like, I would have never known until I just left to look. I was like, oh, there's a difference, and explained it. So,
yeah, and then Arminianism was an inspiration for John Wesley, who then started the Methodists.
Oh, and so and now just to be real clear, for Methodists, though, they're not there's not like a chance. Like, you don't know. In the like everybody's eligible in Methodism.
Yeah, in Methodism.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Although,
right. Hence, maybe is that the reason why it's called Methodism? Is because if you follow this method.
Well, it's because they were Wesley was very obsessed with holiness, with being very personally pious.
Yep.
And they were very. He and everybody in his little Bible club were very methodical about it.
Oh, hence the reason why they're Methodists.
So everybody, yeah. So it actually was a word that their fellow students at university used to tease them.
Oh.
Like, here come the Methodists.
Here come the Methodists. Look at them.
Neener, neener, neener. And they kind of tried it on. They were like, I like that. We are Methodists.
That's right. We are.
Yeah.
We own that. That's right. Okay. So I still, we're talking about salvation here, yes. Folks. So did you find your quote?
Oh, what I was looking for was the Calvinist view has, there's an acronym, TULIP.
Okay.
Which is total depravity, mm-hmm. unconditional election, mm. limited atonement, mm-hmm. irresistible grace, mm-hmm. and perseverance of the saints. And I don't want to dig into all of those too much, but you can kind of like see the pattern from...
Yeah, it kind of looks like a tulip.
Right. cup. Yeah.
That's my salvation there. That's what's going to save me. And folks, I'm not making light of this. Like some of, you know, this, I'd like to think that our listeners for Radical Love Live are, you know, across the spectrum. So I'm not here making light of, you know, beliefs. I really am not. But it is, I do find it fascinating that, you know, just how much goes into any kind of tradition in the notion of a faith tradition. And, you know, it's been around for a while, so, you know, all these different thoughts, and there are lots of people who think about these things. So
When I started studying theology, I was amazed, one, by the fact that there was no theological question that I had that somebody hadn't thought about before.
Of course, right?
Which is amazing. But also this idea of, like, how many different versions of Christianity there have been over the last 2,000 years, and that modern people aren't necessarily privy to all the different ways that it could have gone.
Of course.
And that some of the ideas now have only existed for the last couple hundred years.
Right.
And that we're not accessing all the stuff that Augustine and Origen and Anselm and all these, you know.
The early dudes.
Yes.
Yeah, some of which were even pre-institution, you know, pre-church, where before the Council of Nicaea. Like you think about the early desert mothers and fathers who I resonate with. I don't know what that was like, but I visualize them roaming around thinking about things and, you know, this experience and just, you know, but it was a very connected mystical side of that.
Like Athanasius and those.
Yes.
Those
folks, yeah. I mean, they were like, they were sensing more than they were thinking, right? They were feeling this spirit and in this connection. And of course, you know, they were considering about, you know, the story of Jesus. I mean, they were hearing it, but they pondered these things and prayed upon it and meditated upon it and, like, you know, like, yeah, and before the institution came. And I like to think I do that as well. That's my point in all that, though, is their salvation different than what our salvation is today?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think it may be, we may use different words mm-hmm. to describe it, but I think ultimately if the fruits, and that's what, you know, one of the things Jesus says is judge them by their fruits.
Yep.
If the fruits of it are, I start caring about other people as well as myself, love your neighbor as yourself.
You mean that great commandment?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then I think salvation, like the fuse has been lit on salvation.
Okay, I like your analogy. So let me ask you a follow-up question.
Yes.
If the fuse is lit,
yes,
and it's about ready to go off, and, you know, in this case, it would be one's life, my life. Like, this is my fuse of my life. Like, it's about ready to blow up, and I'm done. But I have never claimed salvation or asked for forgiveness or anything else. Will I be saved? Is there salvation for me? Because I heard it, but I didn't make an official pronouncement or anything else. But I was doing this, and I was bearing good fruit. Can someone be saved in that?
Or salvation? I think so.
Okay. Well,
I mean, there's not any record of the apostles, you know, getting down on their knees and being like, saying the believer's prayer, like, Jesus, come into my heart, or whatever. Like, they started believing things and started doing things. You know, I mean, Paul got knocked to the ground, but...
Yeah. Well, you know why I asked...
His salvation was just admitting what he now believed.
Okay, and maybe that is the salvation, because that's... I get why a lot of folks have really big problems with the notion of salvation, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in the context of institution and the different denominations and how it's perceived to, in myself including, and I could be wrong, but these are my perceptions, so they're real to me, is I have to do these following things in order to be saved. And if I don't, then I'm not going to be saved. And I keep going back to the story about a friend of mine who I used to work with in years past, a devout Southern Baptist who was, oh my God, this guy was awesome, awesome, awesome. But we got into this conversation about what happens to somebody if they are not shown Christ. And in this context, it was because he would go to China to deliver Bibles. And so I asked him, like, well, what happens if you don't get to that one person? And he's like, well, then, you know, they're kind of done. And I'm like, that made no sense to me because they were never, like, how can you say that? That just like, no, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah, and I don't agree with that. I think it's that everybody's judged by what they know. That if you're kind of doing the best you can with what you've got, that, you know, because faith, the Bible says that faith in Jesus is actually a gift. Like you can't have faith on your own without grace. And that's what irresistible grace in the Calvinist method is.
Okay. That's a great way to look at it. So,
can I tell you the joke about the missionary that went to somebody like in a remote area who'd never heard of Jesus?
Well, you can share that joke again because people might laugh. Go for it.
Yeah. He goes to this guy and he says, you know, hey, have you heard about Jesus? And I was like, no, I haven't. He says, well, if you believe in Jesus, you will be saved. If not, you're going to be doomed. And the guy says, well, what if I haven't heard of Jesus? He said, well, then you'd be okay because you'd be saved, you know, by whatever it is that you already believe. He said, well, why did you tell me then?
But I'm bumped. Which is, it's a joke, but it's true. It's like, well, then why did you tell me?
Yeah, you made my life harder.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for nothing there, dude.
Yeah.
So salvation.
Yes.
Is there any, like, strict, retract. There is not a strict way to be saved is salvation. Maybe to some, but, and so
there's a formula, you know, Paul says, if you declare Jesus with your mouth and believe in your heart, then you're, you know, that's evidence that you're saved.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, there's a lot of people that hold on to that formula, but I don't think there is a formula.
Okay.
You know, I think it's kind of a change in orientation, and it's different for every person. You know, we don't know what kind of communication Jesus is having with anybody other than ourselves.
That is very true.
You know, I think that if there is a heaven, that there'll be a lot of surprises there. Be like, oh, you're here.
It's like, whoa.
Oh, I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. I was like, you're not the other person. I was like, oh my God, how did I get here?
But, you know, one thing I do want to address before we, you know, before we get to the end of this episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there may be people who are saying, wait, if Jesus dying on the cross wasn't the sacrifice to pay for the price of my sins, what was it?
Yeah.
You know, was that just like a waste of a perfectly good Messiah? Like, he killed
you. Right, in wood.
Right. Yeah. But that's another thing where we look back into history, that there are multiple interpretations of Christ's work on the cross.
Okay.
Or collectively, his life, death, and resurrection. People look at, like, all, because his teaching, you know, Jesus didn't teach about the cross.
No, he did not, did he?
No.
He told people something was going to happen to him.
No spoilers. Yeah,
but he wasn't, there was no foreshadowing there.
But there are different historical interpretations of the cross. There is the sacrificial model, but there's also one that's called Christus Victor, which is Christ as the victor. Christ as the winner.
I saw that on my AI thing.
Where Christ conquers death and all the works of Satan. So it's a different, it's a victorious, like, the magic was you killed me and I came back.
And
now we've conquered death, which came into the world back at original sin.
Yep, yep. And so I've conquered it.
Right, which is totally different than I'm the sacrificial lamb that has to be killed in order to pay the price.
Yeah, I was just processing. You're absolutely right. That's you're not the victim. You are you're the opposite. You're
right.
Not.
You can't kill me.
I can't. Yeah, exactly.
Death proof.
You can't kill me.
And then there's another interpretation, which is the moral example interpretation, which is Jesus goes head to head with the religious authorities at the time. He doesn't back down, and he gets killed for it. It's the kind of like nonviolent protester version. He's like, this is what it means to be, to have eternal life, is to, you know, put your life on the line for your brothers, for what you believe in, and then you'll be rewarded. And you see a lot of that in more liberal churches. In progressive churches, you see that's the example of, like, we are following the kind of social justice.
Yeah.
But I think that the cross actually does a little bit of all these things. And that, you know, when Paul is writing about the cross, he's pulling metaphors from everywhere to try to explain it, because it's a mystery. It actually can't be pinned down.
Right.
He's using the sacrifice metaphor, but he's also using ransom, which is a whole different thing. There were people who thought that Jesus had to die as a ransom to, because Satan had everybody captive.
Yes, I saw that in the printout from
AI. Yeah, it was like dumping a bag, you know, duffel bag full of money in, you know, into hell. So
here, so he could be free. All right.
Which is obviously a metaphor, you know, like trying to somehow capture some aspect of the cross.
Maybe. Maybe. I don't
know. But then there's legal metaphors. There's justification, which we've already touched on a little bit.
Yeah. I'm a little sketchy on that one, as we all know. Okay. I want to go to the third one, that it is the peaceful protester, the Gandhi approach, right? Or Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah.
Is there a name for that one? Like, what's that called? Like
moral exemplar.
Moral exemplar.
Yeah.
Okay, because that kind of resonates with me. It's like, yeah, that's me. Like, you know, I don't think I'm the only one in this world that, you know, can claim to be. I call myself a Christian. I am a Christian. I practice this faith in what, how it connects with me and my framework of faith, but the notion of this particular dude and all of those miracles that he did, I'm like, okay, yeah, sure, that's great. But I also, like, I don't know, maybe he's just an ordinary guy, and just like people have thought he was really cool and he's very charismatic and could tell, you know, a good story and stuff like that. And I was like, ah, wow. And so next thing you know, we have miracles happening and he conquers death and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, okay, but okay, maybe that none of that happened. Just simply, the guy was saying, "Hey, yo, don't be such a, you know." I was going to use bad language, so I can't do that on this podcast. otherwise, we get a rating. But he was saying, "Yeah, don't do these things. Just love one another. Can you just do that and and not like take advantage of others and be abusive? Like, can you just do that?"
Right. Yeah. Right. And there are entire branches of Christianity that are built around that. Or do what Jesus did, live a Christ-like life, love one another, be good.
Yeah, be good.
Yeah.
Just be good.
like Bill and Ted, like, be good to each other and, you know, be excellent and party on.
Yeah, party on. Yeah. Oh, that's different.
So. I just pulled up the Magnificat, which is the prayer that in the Gospel of Luke that Mary prays when she finds out that she's pregnant with Jesus.
Yes.
And there's a hint here that Jesus might have gotten some of these lessons from his mom, because Mary says, you know, she's predicting like what the world's going to be like. You know, my soul magnifies the Lord, my spirit rejoices in God, my Savior. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say, he has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. Mm. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty.
Wow.
This is not a story of, you know, I personally go to the altar and ask for salvation. This is like redemption of the systems of the world.
Yeah, I'm here to, again, I have to keep this PG or G, mess things up.
That's right. I'm going to kick butt and take names.
Yes.
So I think these are some interesting ways to like open up the idea of salvation to think about not only how people themselves are saved, but that there might be saving work in the world itself.
Oh, totally. So back to that thing about the sheep and the goat, it really is not individual, but it really is about nations or communities. I think that's a better word for it, you know, communities that this would happen, where we are doing that not just within our own communities, but other communities as well, so that healing takes place across all. So,
right.
And we don't leave anybody out.
That is an important part of living into the kingdom of God.
Right.
That is, this is how we start to treat each other now, and then it will eventually come into fruition later on.
I like it.
Yeah.
Wow. So what are any final thoughts as we're wrapping up this episode that you want to share?
Wow, we covered a lot of territory. There isn't a neat summary to this.
No.
It's really is just for folks that care about these things, that care about the nature of salvation, is that you can't pin it down to a single formula. Even Paul, who's kind of our expert on it, couldn't. That's why he was using, you know, half a dozen different kind of metaphors to get at it, because it is still a mystery. So it's one of those things, it's more of a dynamic thing to think about and just to be open to revelation about, rather than to try to pin it down to a formula.
Well said. Kelly, again, always an awesome conversation that we have. I hope our listeners benefit from this as well. So you can always check us out on radicallove.live. And, of course, you know, these podcasts are all put out there on the major platforms. So, you know, Kelly, I always enjoy doing this and look forward to doing another one.
I do, too.
All right.
All right. Thanks for a good conversation.
Likewise. Thanks. Take care, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Radical Love Live, co-hosted by Mark Dilcom and Kelly Wilson. All rights reserved. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, and other popular podcast platforms. Go to radicallovelive.com to learn more about us, watch recordings of our live events, and listen to our podcast. We also invite you to check out what Kelly and Mark are doing by going to our websites. Find Kelly at kellywilson.com and Mark at markdilcom.com. This is Radical Love Live, where we explore faith outside the boxes.